I am not the world's best shot, anyhow. She ducked into a room. I came up to it, and again I hesitated. Sheer habit. It was the ladies' room. But only a moment. I slammed the door open and looked around, gun ready. Something hit me back of my right ear. It seemed to me that I took a long, leisurely time in getting to the floor. I can give no clear account of the next few moments. In the first place, I was out cold, for a time at least. I remember a struggle and some shouts. "Look out! Damn her, she's bitten me! Watch your hands, watch your hands!" Then somebody said more quietly, "Bind her hands and feet now, careful." Somebody said, "How about him?" And someone else answered, "Later, he's not really hurt." I was still practically out as they left, but I began to feel a flood of life stirring back into me. I sat up, feeling extreme urgency about something. I got up, staggering a little, and went to the door. I hesitated there, looked out cautiously. Nobody was in sight. I stepped out and trotted down the corridor, away from the direction of the conference hall. I slowed down momentarily at the outer door, then realized with a shock that I was naked and tore on down the hallway toward the men's wing. There I grabbed the first clothes I could find and pulled them on. I found a pair of shoes much too small for me, but it didn't seem to matter. I ran back toward the exit, fumbled, and found the switch. The door opened. I thought I made a clean escape, but somebody shouted, "Sam!" just as I was going out. I did not wait, but plunged on out. At once, I had my choice of 6 doors, and then 3 more beyond the one I picked. The warren we called the offices, being arranged to permit any number of people to come and go without being noticed, was served by a spaghetti-like mess of tunnels. I came up finally inside a Subway fruit and book stall, nodded to the proprietor, who seemed unsurprised, and swung the counter gate up and mingled with the crowd. It was not a route I had used before. I caught the upriver jet express and got off at the first station. I crossed over to the downriver side, waited around the change window, until a man came up who displayed quite a bit of money as he bought his counter. I got on the same train he did and got off when he did. At the first dark spot, I rabbit-punched him. Now I had money and was ready to operate. I did not know quite why I had to have money, but I knew that I needed it for what I was about to do. Seven. Language grows, so they say, to describe experience of the race using it. Experience first, language second. How can I tell how I felt? I saw things around me with a curious double vision, as if I stared at them through rippling water. Yet I felt no surprise and no curiosity about this. I moved like a sleepwalker, unaware of what I was about to do. But I was wide awake, fully aware of who I was, where I was, what my job at the section had been. There was no amnesia. My full memories were available to me at any moment. And, although I did not know what I was about to do, I was always aware of what I was doing, and sure that each act was the necessary, purposeful act at that moment. They say that post-hypnotic commands work something like that. I don't know. I am a poor hypnotic subject. I felt no particular emotion most of the time, except the mild contentment that comes from being at work, which needs to be done. That was up on the conscious level, and I repeat, I was fully awake. Someplace, more levels down than I understand about, I was excruciatingly unhappy, terrified and filled with guilt. But that was down, way down, locked and suppressed. I was hardly aware of it, and in no practical way affected by it. I knew that I had been seen to leave. That shout of Sam had been intended for me. Only two persons knew me by that name, and the old man would have used my right name. So Mary had seen me leave. It was a good thing, I thought, that she had let me find out where her private apartment was. It would be necessary presently to booby-trap it against her next use of it. In the meantime, I must get on with work and keep from being picked up. I was in a warehouse district, moving through it cautiously, all my agents training at work to avoid being conspicuous. Shortly I found what seemed to be a satisfactory building. There was a sign. Loft for lease. See rental agent on ground floor. I scouted it thoroughly, noted the address, then doubled back to the nearest Western Union booth two squares behind me. There I sat down at a vacant machine and sent the following message. Expedite two cases, Tiny Tots, Talky Tales. Same discount consigned to Joel Freeman. And added the address of the empty loft. I sent it to Roscoe and Dillard, jobbers and manufacturers agents, Des Moines, Iowa. As I left the booth, the sight of one of the quick feedy chain of all-night restaurants reminded me that I was very hungry. But the reflex cut off at once, and I thought no more about it. I returned to the warehouse building, found a dark corner in the rear, and settled quietly back to wait for dawn and business hours. I must have slept. I have a dim recollection of ever-repeating, claustrophobic nightmares. From daylight until 9 o'clock, I hung around a hiring hall, studying the notices. It was the one place in the neighborhood where a man of no occupation would not attract attention. At 9 o'clock, I met the rental agent as he unlocked his office and leased the loft, paying him a fat squeeze on the side for immediate possession while the paperwork went through on the deal. I went up to the loft, unlocked it, and waited. About 10:30, my crates were delivered. I let the teamsters leave. Three were too many for me, and I was not ready in any case. After they were gone, I opened one crate, took out one cell, warmed it, and got it ready. Then I went downstairs, found the rental agent again, and said, "Mr. Greenberg, could you come up for a moment? I want to see about making some changes in the lighting." He fussed, but agreed to do so. When we entered the loft, I closed the door behind us and led him over to the open crate. "Here," I said, "if you will just lean over there, you will see what I mean. If I could just..." I got him around the neck with a grip that cut off his wind, ripped his jacket and shirt up, and with my free hand, transferred a master from the cell to his bare back, then held him tight for a moment until his struggles stopped. Then I led him up, tucked his shirt back in, and dusted him off. When he had recovered his breath, I said, "What news from Des Moines?" "What do you want to know?" he asked. "How long have you been out?" I started to explain, but he interrupted me with, "Let's have a direct conference and not waste time." I skinned up my shirt, he did the same, and we sat down on the edge of the unopened case, back to back, so that our masters could be in contact. My own mind was merely blank, and I have no idea how long the conference went on. I watched a fly droning around a dusty cobweb, seeing it, but not thinking about it. The building superintendent was our next recruit. He was a large Swede, and it took both of us to hold him. After that, Mr. Greenberg called up the owner of the building, and insisted that he simply had to come down and see some horrendous mishap that had occurred to the structure. Just what, I don't know. I was busy with the super, opening and warming several more cells. The owner of the building was a real prize, and we all felt quiet satisfaction, including, of course, he himself. He belonged to the Constitution Club, the membership list of which read like an index of who's who in finance, government, and industry. Better still, the club boasted the most famous chef in town. It was an even chance that any given member would be lunching there if he were in the city. It was pushing noon. We had no time to lose. The super went out to buy suitable clothes and a satchel for me, and sent the owner's chauffeur up to be recruited as he did so. At 12:30 we left, the owner and I, in his own car. The satchel contained 12 masters, still in their cells but ready. The owner signed J. Hardwick Potter and Guest. One of the flunkies tried to take my bag, but I insisted that I needed it to change my shirt before lunch. We fiddled around in the washroom until we had it to ourselves, save for the attendant, whereupon we recruited him and sent him out with a message to the resident manager that a guest had taken ill in the washroom. After we took care of the manager, he obtained a white coat for me, and I became another washroom attendant. I had only 10 masters left, but I knew that the cases would be picked up from the warehouse loft and delivered to the club shortly. The regular attendant and I used up the rest of those I had been able to bring before the lunch hour rush was over. One guest surprised us while we were busy, and I had to kill him, as there was no time to save him for recruiting. We stuffed him into the mop closet. There was a lull after that, as the cases had not yet arrived. Hunger reflex nearly doubled me over. Then it dropped off sharply, but still persisted. I told the manager, who had me served one of the best lunches I have ever eaten, in his office. The cases arrived just as I was finishing. During the drowsy period that every gentleman's club has in the mid-afternoon, we secured the place. By 4 o'clock, everyone present in the building, members, staff, and guests, were with us. From then on, we simply processed them in the lobby, as the doorman passed them in. Later in the day, the manager phoned Des Moines for 4 more cases. Our big prize came that evening. A guest, the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. We saw a real victory in that. The Treasury Department is charged with the safety of the President. Eight. The jubilation caused by the capture of a high key official was felt by me only as absent-minded satisfaction. Then I thought no more about it. We, the human recruits, I mean, hardly thought at all. We knew what we were to do each instant, but we knew it only at the moment of action, as a high school horse gets his orders, responds to them instantly, and is ready for the next signal from his rider. High school horse and rider is a good comparison, as far as it goes. But it goes not nearly far enough. The horseman has, partly at his disposal, the intelligence of the horse. The masters had at their disposal not only our full intelligences, but also tapped directly our memory and experiences. We communicated for them between masters, too. Sometimes we knew what we were talking about. Sometimes we did not. Such spoken words went through the servant, but the servant had no part in more important, direct master-to-master conferences. During these we sat quietly and waited until our riders were through conferring, then rearranged our clothing to cover them up, and did whatever was necessary. There was such a conference on a grand scale after the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury was recruited. I know no more of it than you do, although I sat in on it. I had no more to do with words spoken by me for my master than had the audio relay buried behind my ear to do with words it sounded. The relay was silent all this time, incidentally. My phone proper I had left behind me. I, like it, was a communication instrument, nothing more. Some days after I was recruited, I gave the club manager new instructions about how to order shipments of masters' carrying cells. I was fleetingly aware, as I did so, that 3 more ships had landed, but I was not aware of their locations. My overt knowledge was limited to a single address in New Orleans. I thought nothing about it. I went on with my work. After the day spent at the club, I was a new special assistant to Mr. Potter, and spent the days in his office, and the nights, too. Actually, the relationship may have reversed. I frequently gave oral instructions to Potter. Or perhaps I understood the social organization of the parasites as little now as I did then. The relationship may have been more flexible, more anachronistic, and vastly more subtle than I have the experience to imagine. I knew, and my master certainly knew, that it was well for me to stay out of sight. Through me, my master knew as much of the organization we called the Section as I did. It knew that I was one human known to the old man who had been recruited. And my master knew, I am sure, that the old man would not cease to search for me, to recapture me or kill me. It seems odd that I did not choose to change bodies and to kill mine. We had vastly more potential recruits available than we had masters. I did not think it could have felt anything parallel to human squeamishness. Masters newly delivered from their transit cells frequently damaged their initial hosts. We always destroyed the damaged host and found a new one for the master. Contrariwise, my master, by the time he chose me, had controlled no less than 3 human hosts: Jarvis, Miss Haynes, and one of the girls in Barnes's office, probably the secretary. And in the course of it, had no doubt acquired both sophistication and skill in the control of human hosts. It could have changed horses with ease. On the other hand, would a skilled cowhand have destroyed a well-trained workhorse in favor of an untried, strange mount? That may have been why I was hidden and saved. Or perhaps I don't know what I am talking about. What does a bee know about Beethoven? After a time, the city was secured, and my master started taking me out on the streets. I do not mean to say that every inhabitant of the city wore a hump. No, not by more than 99%. The humans were very numerous, and the masters still very few. But the key positions in the city were all held by our own recruits, from the cop on the corner to the mayor and the chief of police, not forgetting ward bosses, church ministers, board members, and any and all who were concerned with public communications and news. The vast majority continued with their usual affairs, not only undisturbed by the masquerade, but unaware that anything had happened. Unless, of course, one of them happened to be in the way of some purpose of a master, in which case he was disposed of to shut his mouth. This used up potential hosts, but there was no need to be economical. One of the disadvantages we worked under in serving our masters, or perhaps I should say, one of the disadvantages our masters worked under, was the difficulty of long-distance communication. It was limited to what human hosts could say in human speech, over ordinary communication channels, and was further limited, unless the channel was secured throughout, by conventionalized code messages, such as the one I had sent ordering the first 2 shipments of masters. Oh, no doubt the masters could communicate ship to ship, and probably ship to home base, but there was no ship nearby. This city had been stormed as a prize of opportunity, as a direct result of my raid on Des Moines in my previous life. Such communication through servants was almost certainly not adequate to the purposes of the masters. They seemed to need frequent, direct, body-to-body conference to coordinate their actions. I am no expert in exotic psychologies. Some of those who are maintain that the parasites are not discrete individuals, but cells of a larger organism, in which case, but why go on? They seem to need direct contact conferences. I was sent to New Orleans for such a conference. I did not know I was going. I went out on the street, as usual, one morning, then went to the uptown launching platform and ordered a cab. Cabs were scarce. I thought about moving over to the other side and catching the public shuttle, but the thought was immediately suppressed. After a considerable wait, my cab was lifted to the loading ramp, and I started to get in. I say started to, as an old gentleman bustled up and climbed into it ahead of me. I received an order to dispose of him, which order was immediately countermanded by telling me to go slow and be careful, as if even the masters were not always sure of themselves. I said, "Excuse me, sir, but this cab is taken." "Quite," the elderly man replied. "I've taken it." He was a picture of self-importance, from briefcase to dictatorial manner. He could easily have been a member of the Constitution Club, but he was not one of our own, as my master knew and told me. "You will have to find another," I said reasonably. "Let's see your queue ticket." I had taken my ticket from the rack as soon as I reached the platform. A cab carried the launching number showed by my ticket. I had him, but he did not stir. "Where are you going?" he demanded. "New Orleans," I answered, and learned for the first time my destination. "Then you can drop me off in Memphis." I shook my head. "It's out of my way." "All of 15 minutes." He seemed to have difficulty controlling his temper, as if he were not often crossed. "You, sir, must know the rules about sharing cabs in these days of shortages. You cannot preempt a public vehicle unreasonably." He turned from me. "Driver, explain to this person the rules." The driver stopped picking his teeth just long enough to say, "It's nothing to me. I pick him up, I take him, I drop him. Settle it between yourselves, or I'll ask the dispatcher for another fare." I hesitated, not yet having been instructed. Then I found myself chucking my bag in and climbing inside. "New Orleans," I said, "with stop at Memphis." The driver shrugged and signaled the control tower. The other passenger snorted and paid me no further attention. Once in the air, he opened his briefcase and spread papers across his knees. I watched him with disinterest. Presently, I found myself shifting my position to let me get at my gun easily. The elderly man shot out a hand and grabbed my wrist. "Not so fast, son," he said. And his features broke into the satanic grin of the old man himself. My reflexes are fast, but I was at the disadvantage of having everything routed from me to my master, passed on by it, and action routed back to me. "How much delay is that? A millisecond? I don't know." As I was drawing, I felt the bell of a gun against my ribs. "Take it easy." With his other hand, he thrust something against my side. I felt a prick, and then through me spread the warm tingle of a jolt of Morpheus, taking hold. I've been knocked out by that drug twice before, and I've given it more times than that. I knew what it was. I made one more attempt to pull my gun free, then sank forward. I was vaguely aware of voices. Voices which had been going on for some time, before I got around to sorting them out as meaning. Someone was handling me roughly, and someone said, "Watch out for the ape." Another voice replied, "It's all right. His tendons are cut." To which the first voice retorted, "But he's still got teeth, hasn't he?" "Yes," I thought fretfully, "and if you get close enough, I'll bite you with them, too." The mark about cut tendons seemed to be true. None of my limbs would move. But that did not worry me as much as being called an ape, and not being able to resent it. It was a shame, I thought, to call a man names when he can't protect himself. I wept a little, and then fell into a stupor. Feeling better, son? The old man was leaning over the end of my bed, staring at me thoughtfully. His chest was bare and covered with grizzled hair. He showed a slight paunch. I said.
Pretty good, I guess.
I started to sit up and found I could not move. The old man came around to the side of the bed. We can take those restraints off now, he said, fiddling with clasps. Didn't want you hurting yourself. There. I sat up, rubbing myself. I was quite stiff. Now, said the old man, how much do you remember? Report.
Remember?
You were with them. Remember? They caught you. Do you remember anything after the parasite got to you? I felt a sudden wild fear and clutched at the sides of the bed. Boss, they know where this place is. I told them. No, they don't, he answered quietly. Because these aren't the section offices you remember. Once I was convinced that you had made a clean getaway, I had the old offices evacuated. They don't know about this hangout, I think. So you remember? Of course I remember. I got out of here, out of the old offices, and went up. My thoughts raced ahead of my words. I had a sudden full image of holding a live, moist master in my bare hand, ready to place it on the back of the rental agent. I threw up on the sheet. The old man took a corner of it, wiped my mouth, and said gently, Go ahead. I swallowed and said, Boss, they're all over the place. They've got the city. I know. Same as Des Moines, and Minneapolis, and St. Paul, and New Orleans, and Kansas City. Maybe more. I don't know. I can't be every place. He looked sour and added, It's like fighting with your feet in a sack. We're losing. Fast. He scowled and added, We can't even clamp down on the cities we know about. It's very... Good grief, why not? You should know. Because older and wiser heads than mine are still to be convinced that there is a war on. Because when they take over a city, everything goes on as before. I stared at him. Never mind, he said gently. You are the first break we've had. You're the first victim to be recaptured alive. And now we find you remember what happened to you. That's important. And your parasite is the first live one we've managed to capture and keep alive. We'll have a chance to... He broke off. My face must have been a mask of terror. The notion that my master was still alive and might get to me again was more than I could stand. The old man took my arm and shook it. Take it easy, son, he said mildly. You're still pretty sick and pretty weak. Where is it? Huh? The parasite? Don't worry about it. You can see it if you wish. It's living off your opposite number, a red orangutan, name of Napoleon. It's safe. Kill it. Hardly. We need it alive for study. I must have gone to pieces, for he slapped me a couple of times. Take a brace, he said. I hate to bother you when you're sick, but it's got to be done. We've got to get everything you remember down on wire, so level off and fly right. I pulled myself together and started making a careful, detailed report of all that I could remember. I described renting the loft and recruiting my first victim, but now we moved on from there to the Constitution Club. The old man nodded. Logical. You were a good agent, even for them.
You don't understand, I objected. I didn't do any thinking. I knew what was going on, but that was all. It was as if... As if...
I paused, stuck for words. Never mind. Get on with it.
After we recruited the club manager, the rest was easy. We took them as they came in, and...
Names?
Oh, certainly. Myself. Greenberg. M.C. Greenberg. Thor Hansen. J. Hardwick Potter. The chauffeur, Jim Wakely. A little guy called Jake, who was washroom attendant at the club. But I believe he had to be disposed of later. His master would not let him take time out for necessities. Then there was a manager. I never did get his name. I paused, letting my mind run back over that busy afternoon and evening in the club, trying to make such of each recruit. Oh my God. What is it? The secretary. The assistant secretary of the treasury.
You mean you got him?
Yes, the first day.
What day was that? How long has it been?
God, Chief, the Treasury Department protects the President. But I was not talking to anyone. There was just a hole in the air where the old man had been. I lay back, exhausted. I started sobbing softly into my pillow. After a while, I went to sleep. Nine. I woke up with my mouth foul, my head buzzing, and a vague sense of impending disaster. Nevertheless, I felt fine by comparison. A cheerful voice said, "Feeling better?" A small brunette creature was bending over me. She was as cute a little bug as I have ever seen, and I was well enough to appreciate the fact, however faintly. She was dressed in a very odd costume. What there was of it. Skin-tight white shorts, a wisp of practically transparent stuff that restrained her breasts. But not much. And a sort of metal carapace that covered the back of her neck, her shoulders, and went on down her spine. Better, I admitted. Then made a wry face. Mouth taste unpleasant? Like a Balkan cabinet meeting. Here. She gave me some stuff in a glass. It was spicy and burned a little, and it washed away the bad taste at once. No, she went on. Don't swallow it. Spit it out like a little man, and I'll get you some water. I obeyed. I'm Doris Marston, she went on. Your day nurse.
Glad to know you, Doris, I answered,
and stared at her with increasing appreciation. Say, why the get-up? Not that I don't like it, but you look like a refugee from a comic book. She looked down at herself and giggled. I feel like a chorus girl, but you'll get used to it. I did. I'm already used to it. I like it fine, but why? The old man's orders. I started to ask why again, then knew why, and I started feeling worse again. I shut up. Doris went on. Now for some supper. She got a tray and sat down on my bed. I don't believe I want anything to eat. Open up, she said firmly, or I'll rub it in your hair. There, that's a good boy. Between gulps, taken in self-defense, I managed to get out. I feel pretty good. Give me one jolt of gyro and I'm back on my feet. No stimulants for you, she said flatly, still shoveling it in. Special diet and lots of rest, with maybe a sleepy pill later. That's what the man says. What's wrong with me? Extreme exhaustion, starvation, and the first case of scurvy I ever saw in all my born days. As well as scabies and lice, but we got those whipped. There, now you know. And if you tell the doctor I told you, I'll call you a liar to your face. Turn over on your tummy. I did so, and she started changing dressings. I appeared to be spotted with sores. The stuff she used stung a bit, then felt cool. I thought about what she had told me, and tried to remember just how I had lived under my master. "Stop trembling," she said. "Are you having a bad one?"
"I'm all right," I told her.
I did manage to stop shaking and to think it over calmly. As near as I could remember, I had not eaten during that period oftener than every second or third day.
Bathing?
Let me see.
Why, I hadn't bathed at all.
I had shaved every day and put on a clean shirt. That was a necessary part of the masquerade, and the master knew it. On the other hand, as far as I could remember, I had never taken off my shoes from the time I had stolen them until the old man had recaptured me. And they had been too tight to start with.
"What sort of shape are my feet in?" I asked.
"Don't be nosy," Doris advised me. "Now turn over on your back." I like nurses. They are calm and earthy and very tolerant. Miss Briggs, my night nurse, was not the mouth-watering job that Doris was. She had a face like a jaundiced horse. But she had a fine figure for a woman her age, hard and well cared for. She wore the same sort of musical comedy rig that Doris sported. But she wore it with a no-nonsense air and walked like a grenadier guard. Doris, bless her heart, jiggled pleasantly as she walked. Miss Briggs refused to give me a second sleeping pill when I woke up in the night and had the horrors. But she did play poker with me and skinned me out of half a month's pay. I tried to find out from her about the president matter, for I figured the old man had either won or lost by that time. But she wasn't talking. She would not admit that she knew anything about parasites, flying saucers, or whatnot. And she herself, sitting there dressed in a costume that could have only one purpose. I asked her what the public news was then. She maintained that she was too busy lately to look at a cast. So I asked to have a stereo box moved into my room so I could catch a newscast. She said I would have to ask the doctor about that. I was on the quiet list. I asked when in the deuce I was going to see this so-called doctor. She said she didn't know. The doctor had been very busy lately. I asked how many other patients there were in the infirmary anyway. She said she really didn't remember. About then her call bell sounded and she left, presumably to see another patient. I fixed her. While she was gone, I cold-decked the next deal so that she got a pat hand. Then I wouldn't bet against her. I got to sleep later on and was awakened by Miss Briggs slapping me in the face with a cold, wet washcloth. She got me ready for breakfast. Then Doris relieved her and brought it to me. This time I fed myself, and while I was chomping, I tackled her for news, with the same perfect score I had made with Miss Briggs. Nurses run a hospital as if it were a nursery for backward children. Davidson came around to see me after breakfast. "Heard you were here," he said. He was wearing shorts and nothing else, except his left arm was covered by a dressing. "More than I've heard," I complained. "What happened to you?"
"Bee stung me."
I dropped that subject. If he didn't want to tell how he'd gotten burned, that was his business. I went on. "The old man was in here yesterday, getting my report, when he left very suddenly. Seen him since?"
"Yep."
"Well," I answered.
"Well, how about you?
Are you straightened out? Have the psych boys cleared you for classified matters or not?"
"Is there any doubt about it?"
"You darn tootin' there's doubt. Poor old Jarvis never did pull out of it."
"Huh?"
I hadn't thought about Jarvis. "How is he now?"
"He isn't. Never did get right in his head. Dropped into a coma and died the next day. The day after you left. I mean, the day after you were captured. No apparent reason, just died." Davidson looked me over. "You must be tough."
I did not feel tough. I felt tears of weakness welling up again, and I blinked them back. Davidson pretended not to see and went on conversationally. You should have seen the ruckus you gave us after the slip. The old man took out after you wearing nothing but a gun and a look of grim determination. He would have caught you, too, my money says, but the civil police picked him up, and we had to get him out of hock. Davidson grinned. I grinned feebly myself. There was something both gallant and silly about the old man charging out to save the world single-handed, dressed in his birthday suit. Sorry I missed it. But what else has happened? Lately. Davidson looked me over carefully, then said, Wait a minute. He stepped out of the room and was gone a short time. When he came back, he said, The old man says it's all right. What do you want to know?
Everything. What happened yesterday?
I was in on that one, he answered. That's how I got this. He waved his damaged wing at me. I was lucky, he added. Three agents were killed. Quite a fracas. But how did it come out? How about the president? Was he... Doris bustled into the room. Oh, there you are, she said to Davidson. I told you to stay in bed. You're doing prosthetics at Mercy Hospital right now. The ambulance has been waiting for 10 minutes. He stood up, grinned at her, and pinched her cheek with his good hand. The party can't start until I get there. Well, hurry. Coming. He started out the door with her. I called out, Hey, how about the president? Davidson paused and looked over his shoulder. Oh, him? He's all right. Not a scratch on him. He went on.